Welcome back. Going to talk now, after that introduction to autism spectrum disorder. I want to really talk now about some of the tools that we can use. And what I'm going to do is take each one of those six areas of difference and spend some time within those talking about, well, what tools might be used. So let's start with that difference of repetitive themes and behaviors. Remember, we talked about that. It could be emotion, could be a topic that a person is really interested in. I was part of a meeting with a psychologist, and they said, I want you to know the difference between this part of autism and having something called obsessive compulsive disorder. When you have obsessive compulsive disorder, you have to wash your hands 19 times before you leave the house or whatever it may be, and you're like a slave to it. It does not bring any joy whatsoever. But if this is your difference with ASD and you could wash your hands 19 times and then you go into a building and there's like instant hand sanitizer, or maybe you ask every woman there if they have some instant hand sanitizer in their purse because you would love to wash your hands that many times because it brings often great amounts of joy. So I think there are so many great ways that we can think about tools to partner with this difference in autism spectrum disorder. Could you perhaps interview the expert if you're preaching someday or if you're running a class for children or youth and somebody has a very particular interest in a war? Could they be interviewed about some of their knowledge to share with the group as part of that conversation? Use those areas of interest in a variety of ways. So, for example, you might be able to pair that interest, perhaps that's of trains. So you put scripture memory on a piece of paper decorated with trains. There's a much greater likelihood that individual is going to enjoy scripture memory if it is paired with a paper that has a train on it. Or maybe that person loves thinking about World War II. Maybe you could compare a biblical war to World War II. It's possible that this person loves music, and you could introduce some kind of a concept or a Bible story using song or a particular word. Sometimes even planned activities or things that might be a little scary if you pair them with something you love. So if you know that there's going to be some kind of a planned drill, evacuation, whatever that might be, and that person's job is to hold the football, and footballs bring great amount of joy, there's a better chance that that could go well. Although I will admit, in our particular place, we typically try to get all of those children who are sound sensitive out of the building before the fire alarm rings. That has often worked better for us than trying to pair something up, but just see how your environment works. Sometimes we found that you need to put boundaries around a topic, that a person's brain is just always stuck there. And again, we're going to try to find other things than just words in order to do it. Usually the saying is, if I didn't see it, you didn't say it. There's way more opportunity to think about pictures and visuals. So we often use sticky notes, and it might be used in something like this. Excuse me, is my mom coming to pick me up? And so you give the answer. But is mom going to pick me up today? Is she coming to this room? You give the answer. But so mom's coming to pick me up. How many times do we have to do this back and forth question? You've answered it the same way. How many times? I'm a big believer in sticky notes. And so, again, conversations are all in the head. I'm convinced that that individual is not nearly as concerned whether they know the answer. But if you remember the answer, and since they don't have clear vision into your head, remember that perspective-taking ability, they're asking because they want to make sure you didn't forget. So I often will just take a sticky note, write the answer down, mom is coming to pick you up. Whether the child can read or the adult can read, we just, again, make it a visual of our conversation. Prayer requests, everybody can have one of them. We just make it a visual and put it down there. So now we both know that we can remember the conversation. So in a way, it's making a conversation visual and getting it down on things. So sticky notes, I love them. I use them all the time for answers to questions, for details. Again, now we both can see that we both know the answer. I think another thing that we've had to do sometimes is with a topic, we have put things away. We actually have put a box in a closet, have written something out on a piece of paper and said, you know, you need to put Star Trek or whatever it might be in the box, and we'll take it out at about, did you hear the about? At about, you know, 11 o'clock. Now, you need to be faithful and allow that person to talk about that at about 11 o'clock. But I think that, again, sometimes it's a visual way of saying we need to stop thinking about that. But you know that never works for me either. Somebody says, you need to stop thinking about whatever it is, makes you think about it even more. But this is like a way to put it away. It's safe. We haven't forgotten about it. And we're going to take it out again at about 11 o'clock. And I might literally put a sticky note on that closet door that says, about 11 o'clock. So we both remember when we're going to take that out. Anyway, I think that has a lot of power. So again, those are just a few strategies, and I think that they work well in any setting. But now you all go get your pack of sticky notes and try it out, because it's a pretty fun thing to try. Okay, what about that issue of just desire for sameness? Please don't change my schedule. In fact, don't change anything. One of those things that I showed you yesterday was the opportunity to use a visual schedule. So let me get all these pictures up here a minute. And so again, the idea would be, well, we can make this in pictures. Now let's grow this up to an adult setting. I was at a congregation the other day, and how they use their projection system is they literally projected the order of worship up on the screen, and so there was this sort of red marker line that highlighted what part of the worship service they were on. Same with this, where you can change out pictures. What happened that day, the pastor, who probably needed one of those great time timers, preached a little bit long, and they had to alter the schedule. And I knew that there were several individuals in that congregation who would really struggle with that change, right? So, but without missing a beat, he said, excuse me, Sam, or whoever was running that projection system, would you move that down to hymn number 372, and we'll pick it up from there. So again, nobody got upset. They could see the change in the schedule. It was visual, and they knew where everything was going from there on out. So again, might be visual schedule. Could be that a person really does well with an iPad. One of my favorite apps, and it's I think under $10 still, is called ChoiceWorks, and it allows you to build a visual schedule on an iPad. It's very quick, and you can have it read the order. You can move the pieces over when you're done with them. It's a really nice app to have on a phone or an iPad to go with you. This has some other features too, like waiting for something, and there's this countdown. So there's some good stuff on that particular app. You might want to check that out. The other thing is sometimes the whole day is too much. Sometimes a whole chunk of time is too much. Sometimes we just need to do this if first, then, or if, then, in some cases. But so first we're going to have story time, then a snack break. We only show two options. And then when we're sitting at snack, oh, now it's snack break, and then we're going to do this. So those options can just come in a short amount of time. You know I've been slipping on that apron several times, but I wanted to just show you another application for this. You actually can make a schedule out of objects. And so you might be able to take this piece of fabric and then you have like a paintbrush on here with some Velcro, and then you've got a picture of the Cheerios snack that you're going to be serving, and you've got that on here. And so then you've got a Bible story book, a small one, that represents what's next. So you can actually make a schedule for people that aren't good at interpreting pictures, but would rather be able to see, oh, we're doing these actual items. It's a great way to use this or some kind of a board. You don't have to make an apron out of that. I just love it because I can get so close to people, but it might be a different kind of visual display. So, and then some people, we just use a binder schedule if they're readers. What I really like is so they could come to church or to youth group, and on this side we have the schedule, and then we have a line here that says different day. And the different day side is blank, but we have the binder schedule written out here. If you know that the schedule is going to be different, you can simply take that person and say, oh, we need to fill out your different day schedule because that's what it is today. And then you have the opportunity, again, for people to see every time. It could be a different day, but looks like not today. Oh, today is. So that's a pretty effective way to do things. Again, making changes to the schedule, I've shown you a few of those tools, but many people do appreciate some kind of advanced preparation and warning. So some ways that you can do that, again, even transitions can be challenging. I showed you that larger time timer yesterday. I'll just show you they come in a variety of sizes and applications. So this particular timer is a great way to give that warning. You know what? In 10 minutes, we're going to transition to our lesson or whatever that might be. So people, again, can watch that time disappear. It's a heads up about a transition. I think another way to give information is through that tool that we talked about, that church welcome story. Again, we're going to change now into another Sunday school class. We're going to move from a children's area. Now we're going to attend the adult area. So let's create a story or a video or some way of giving information about that setting. Another tool that's used a lot in the arena of autism spectrum disorder is that of using videos to model what has to be done. So shooting video of how do people sit when they're part of a worship service? How do they sign the register when it comes past? You literally can shoot video of what is expected in that environment so that individual can watch it being done in your setting. It's pretty exciting if you think about it, all of the options that can go into video modeling. And while it's a pretty complex and laid out topic, just to think, okay, well, this person's going to now be part of this setting. Could we shoot some video in there of somebody else doing it, having another person, maybe that individual's age, going through worship? How do we worship? How do we hold books? Those kinds of things. So again, video modeling can be a really powerful way. Don't make it overly complicated. Can you show this person what's going to happen in that environment? Sometimes change in routine, it's helpful to have what we call transition routines. One of my favorite spaces that I was in was in a children's environment where they had, you know, whatever, lots of stuff going here. But against the wall, they had a line of chairs with each child's name on the chair. So listen to this masterful way of doing it, of making a transition. Okay, boys and girls, we're done with our Bible story now. Everybody go to your transition chair. I thought, really, they're not going to know what that is. Oh, they quickly scooted over to their chairs, and there they are waiting. And then the leader goes over and said, now it's time for snack. You may go to the snack table. They all go to the snack table. Do you know what she did when snack was done? You bet. Okay, everybody go to your transition chair. Every transition was made from those chairs. So she put stability on making change by always doing it the same way. I think that's possible to do in other settings, too, where you end a certain segment by saying, okay, you know, now this is done and now we move on. And if every transition has the same words that cue the next opportunity, that can be perhaps helpful. So think about that, whether it's words or whether it's, you know, a certain phrase or those chairs, a certain action. Building in routines in transitions can be really, really helpful. Another thing that I have found for students moving from one space to the next is to allow them to carry an object. And to be honest, I'm not exactly sure why this works, but it's almost like the pressure of having their body move from place to place is too much. But if they're going to move the crayons over to where the teacher needs them, or if they're going to move a note over to somebody in the sanctuary, if they're going to, they have an item, it's almost easier to move the item than it is to move their body into that place. So just something to think about. So those are some ideas, and I got to tell you, I'm going to encourage you at this point to push pause on whatever it is you're using to watch this. Did you catch some good ideas? What did you just hear? Think about that. What are you totally going to try? I know some of you are buying sticky notes even for your own children at home. I've done that a few times with my kinfolk. But what are you going to have in place? What kind of schedules? Did you like the transition chair idea? You know your setting and your environment. What are those things that you might want to put into place? So feel free, even as part of this one video, to just push pause and to come up with that plan. Well, I hope you had a chance to identify a couple of things, at least, that you would be excited to try. I wanted to move on to that difference in the area of language. Let me tell you, this is a big deal in congregations. I know this because I have had to mop up several messes. And let me just tell you, so I sort of warned you about this. If you're going to put down that worship is from 10 o'clock to 10:15, it better be from 10 o'clock to 10:15 on whatever clock you've got in that place, or that individual might call you out on that. Sometimes changing a word, worship usually 10 o'clock to 10:15, will buy you a couple of minutes, but I often recommend just saying worship, offering, prayer, whatever that is, so you just have a sequence without the times, because that's much easier to coordinate, aside from this individual always calculating time while you're moving through those items. Again, please be careful with your church language. I mentioned something like raining cats and dogs, but do you know how many times we use language that would be confusing in a congregational setting? So I will never forget the day that one student vowed he was never going back to church again because somebody asked him if he wanted to give his heart to Jesus. Right? What is that person thinking of? What does giving your heart to Jesus actually mean to this person? We do it all the time, and even Scripture is filled with those ways of using figurative speech, not literal speech. I had one individual where a preacher had said that they could be covered with the blood of Jesus. It took me 6 months to convince that person that what that meant. She was so horrified of that event. So again, we're using words that sometimes have very different meanings to individuals. I know one of my friends who's an adult, there are four people in her church that sit beside Sandra during different events in the worship service so that they can serve as an interpreter. So if they're reading about how God gathers his chicks under his wings, they will simply write in her dictionary, that does not mean that God is a hen, right? And explains what protection that means. Now, they don't have to do it a second time. Once they've explained it once often, Sandra's able to roll with that. She's a bright woman. But those kinds of things just don't make any sense to her. There's another pretty famous speaker in the area of autism. She happens to have autism. She was recounting some of her experiences growing up, and I thought I was just marveled at that. She said, you know, I didn't understand why there was a man at the end of every prayer, right? How do we end a prayer? For Jesus' sake, amen. Why do they put a man at the end of every prayer? And I think, you know, there were some other very confusing images. She was in her 50s when she finally told somebody to pull the car over and took a picture of a rainbow that was like touching the top of a power plant. And because she was always trying to understand what it meant to have the power and the glory. So what's the ending of the Lord's Prayer? For that is the kingdom and the power and the glory. She didn't understand power and glory and had to see this vision in order to understand what that could be. But how about if we had supplied some pictures to her as she was growing up or as part of a worship service? What does God's power and God's glory look like? If those images and those words had been explained, she might have had a very different image of who God is to this day. So again, how can we create those kinds of opportunities? In words, usually less is more. Don't use so many. When you're giving instructions, directions, just, you know, say it short. Like I said, if I didn't see it, you didn't say it. Way better to come with visuals than it is to come with a mouthful of words. That can, again, be very difficult to digest. Limit the verbal interactions. Use direct statements. And remember, when you're giving instructions, please say what you want the person to do as opposed to what you don't want the individual to do. So let's say you just tune in to the last three words of this. I can't believe it. I am really getting irritated with all of you. You walk down the hallway all the time, and what are you doing? Your hands are on everybody next to you. Seriously, how many times do I have to tell you, do not hit your friends? And what did you just hear? Hit your friends, and what a most excellent idea. I'll just think about that over and over. Hit your friends, hit your friends, hit your friends. And so again, we're much better off to say, oh, keep your hands to yourself, or keep your feet on the floor, or keep that liquid in your mouth, instead of don't spit, don't kick, don't hit, because again, you've now planted that idea and that word in an individual's mind. So giving directions one step at a time and also pairing directions with visuals can be super, super helpful. Yep, there's my phrase, and I've done it several times over, but it's really true. If I didn't see it, you didn't say it. Words just don't have all that much power many times. Even to that person who has a lot of words to speak, words going in may not have all that much meaning. So be careful with that. Please take note that if you have a person who's a fluent reader, it does not always mean that comprehension is great. In fact, you may need to explain several concepts. Remember, even that speaker I was talking about, if she would read the words power and glory, to be able to translate that in a setting accurately might really be difficult for this individual who has her doctorate. So we have to really be careful about comprehension of words. And also, especially if you tend to be a leader who uses a lot of jokes or sarcasm, be careful with that. If you are to say to your group before the Christmas program, break a leg, you will have one person who's incredibly confused that you just told them to break that leg. The other thing that I think is so important to remember as well is often we use jokes and you'll have the group laughing except for one person, and then you say something that's not funny to anybody else, but that person just cracks up. Again, you connected with a word or a concept that individual found funny. That's a pretty common occurrence in certain settings as well. So again, those are just some things to think about with the language difference that you'll often see with individuals, and yet lots of great ways to be able to bring in visuals and to be careful with your words and directions. I will say one of the things I often do, if there's something going on in church, I'll often suggest that you have one person come in and serve as the listener, because so often we don't monitor our own words. So this is a great Sunday school example, and this child has done this for like 2 months already, so it was unclear why today it went this way, but the teacher said, I wanted everybody to pick up a carpet square and sit down. So all of the other children inserted the middle step of carry it over to where you have Bible story time and sit on that carpet square there. Can you imagine what this child did, right? Picked up a carpet square, sat down right beside the pile. And again, it would be confusing if somebody would call this kiddo out and say, what did you just do? Are you being smart with me? This would be terribly confusing for this child because they were just following instructions. Very smart preschool Sunday school teacher who went over, understood some of these differences with autism spectrum disorder, and said, you know what, I forgot to insert that middle step. This is what I really wanted to say. Would you pick up a carpet square, carry it over, you know, whatever. So she filled in the remaining steps. But remember that language difference can happen and frequently does when somebody's giving instructions and somebody's following and it just doesn't go the way the leader had intended. Having a listener there to say, oh, but this is what you said, can sometimes be very helpful. So remember that. I want to spend just a little time explaining to you about this thing called sensory differences. I've talked about that a lot, actually, so far, but I've not had a chance to explain what I'm talking about. And I'll tell you, I have seen more and more of this in my observing of students and adults in the last 10 to 15 years than I can even imagine. But certainly when we talk about the senses, we often think about the big five, right? So you've got your sense of hearing, and you got, remember I was talking about the Lord's Supper, your sense of taste, your sense of smell, you know, right? So all of those things are true. Those are the big five. And I just want to point out, in addition to sight, smell, taste, hearing, the touch, often we imagine that as things that we reach out and touch. Remember, touch is also what reaches out and touches you. So like the tags in the back of your clothes or the sock toe line in your shoe, do you know anybody for whom that touching their skin can cause great degree of distress? So again, touch is not just what you reach out and touch, it's also what touches you. But there are way more than five senses. I think I read an article once that was called My 21 Senses. So if you think about that, even your body's ability to take in information and interpret pain, take in information and interpret the temperature of where you are. Another couple I'll just highlight here are your sense of balance. Are you stable? Do you have to move a lot in order to obtain your sense of balance? How is that? Balance is a sensory system. It's information that goes to your brain that's interpreted then. And so how your brain interprets that is pretty key. Proprioception is a large word for basically saying information that comes in through your muscles and joints. So if you're holding a pencil right now, I bet you're not thinking at all about how you're drawing the letters that are going down on the paper or how hard you're holding that pencil. It's just something that's a sort of an automatic sensory system that we have. We get feedback from our muscles and joints all the time. So do I need to move a little bit? Oops, I'm moving from grass to sort of this concrete thing. I need to do this differently. So all of these are systems that are feeding information to our brain, and our brain interprets them. It is most excellent if we are wired at a place that I will just call middle C on a piano keyboard. You know what I'm talking about? Middle C is like right sort of in that center. Middle C is a great place to be because what you're doing is you're blocking out a lot of unnecessary things, but you're taking in what you need to take in. So if you're at middle C, there's a hum in the room, or heating or air conditioning is going on and off, or there's noise on the street going by, we just block it out because it's unimportant information. We can keep focusing on the most important thing. But if that exact voice comes over and says mom or dad in a particular way, oh, we might be right there because that's a voice we need to tune into. So we have this amazing brain and read on sensory systems that is quite elaborate, and middle C is a very comfortable place to be. But for whatever reason, and there are many of them, my mom experienced a season of this when she was going through chemotherapy. For some of us, we're wired way above middle C, just a little bit of input, and it's almost too much. We just, sounds could be too loud, or touch the tags. I just got to get those out of there because I feel it all day long, right? So just a little bit of sensation, and it's too much. And then you've got people on the other end for whom sensation, we need a ton of it. They're way below middle C. Feed me that. My student who was talking in a voice spot like this was that way with hearing and sound. He wasn't monitoring his own voice volume very well. He needed a ton of sound in order to even register. Do you know anybody that when they give you a hug, they squeeze you so tight? And those are these kids that like ram into the room, and they like to wrestle, and they're adults that give handshakes that are so hard, or a clap on the back, because that person is craving touch. So if it feels good to them, it must feel good to you. And yet you've got some people over here that like smells. Oh, they can't stand to come into church because of all the smells. Or now visually they've turned on these decorative lights, and they're just so distracting. So either way, above or below middle C, whether you're either hypersensitive to that sensation or not, you know, you need a ton of it in order to register, it can happen in any one of those sensory areas. Even take food, for example. My son will eat a taco with like 12 packets of the hottest hot sauce on that taco. And I'm like, seriously? How can you even digest that? Where you have some individuals that they get one of those little, you know, crinkly things from the yogurt and they spit it out because it's like just certain textures or foods in their mouth, it has to be light and in a particular way. So any sensory system, you know, hearing, as you've seen, you know, there are many ways to factor for that. So let's think about that. One of the most important things is to know what that sensory difference is and then to be able to jump into that person's shoes, quote unquote, and figure out what areas might be difficult in your setting. What one of those things do you need to alter or change in order to be better? So let's think about that. If it's hearing, if you have somebody who's really sensitive to hearing, could you have some of those sound blockers? Remember that church I was talking to you about that just has them available for people to check out? Provide a choice to leave. Sometimes allowing some break tickets to be in the room to say, you know what, if it gets too loud, feel free to grab that and you may go and do whatever. Having a choice to leave is sometimes providing the opportunity to stay because they know that they can leave that. Could you change or alter the noise, make it a better noise, make it a softer noise, allow that individual to help you choose the noise, that can help. And then turning an unexpected noise into an expected one is almost always the ticket. So if you are using a CD player or whatever kind of player, if that person can push the on button or that person can do this to get the band to start, you've now turned that into an expected noise. That person can prepare for it. So again, find out what the difference is. What can you do? What about vision? Can you have in your sanctuary sort of a place that's a little bit more removed? Maybe there's a corner where people could worship, but they're not going to be distracted by all of the vision around them. In a kid's setting, you might have a classroom tent or throw a tablecloth over a table. Undecorate. I would say don't insist on eye contact if you know that person has ASD. I train students to look at me to say hello, but I was instructed by one of my friends with ASD who said, you know what, your face is so confusing. If I want to listen to your words, I need to look away. I said, seriously, first of all, faces give a lot of, input. Some of us read those as facial expressions, and others are like, why are you moving your mouth and your nose and your eyes? And so if you can't read that on somebody's face, it's confusing. Plus, she said, do you know those movies where, like, you see the action, but you hear the words several seconds later? She said, that's what it's like for me. My vision works very well. My hearing processing is delayed, and so I don't get that information until later. In any event, insisting on eye contact while you're telling a Bible story, I'd just do a comprehension check. Or insisting that a person look at you, especially if they're in trouble, don't do that. You have now created a huge problem. They might be listening to you better with their eyes down. So greetings, yes. And I often say, look at my nose. That doesn't move much. It's pretty stable. Look at my nose to say hello. If it's helpful for you to listen to my words by looking down, you may do that. But you have to know the people in your life before you can make those statements. Again, that information through muscles and joints can sometimes actually be a great source of calming. So having a trampoline in that setting is a way to give some fast input to your proprioceptive system and can sometimes be very calming for a person. Having lotion, and I always let that person pick, and please do not put lotion, rub lotion on a teenager, right? We're talking about younger ones here. Or maybe an elderly person who's really able to give permission for that. But really, sometimes, again, what you're doing is you're giving some nice, firm pressure on their arms, skin, whatever, and that can be really helpful. There's a brushing technique, again, that is sometimes recommended. If this person is having a brushing technique, you might as well learn how to do it, especially if they're with you for over 2 hours, because usually that's a therapy that's applied every 2 hours. So learn how to do it. If you're on an overnight retreat, you might as well bring it along, because that might provide an avenue of calm for that individual. Animal walks, again, bear walks, crab walks, getting some pressure on your muscles and joints can be really helpful. Providing like a milk crate with a bunch of books in it, heavy loads, heavy backpacks, those lap animals that I had described where you put rice on people's laps, those things can all be really helpful. And it looks like, carrying around a sibling can be a way to provide that heavy load as well. So how can we, give some of those things so people can stay calm? How would you know what to do? Well, you got to get to know the person. What works for that individual? What works for one is not going to work for the other. So you have to find out what is calming for that person, what helps regulate that system. Before I move to the next section, I just have to tell a story from my friend Sandra, because it has been so meaningful to me. She does process sensation a bit differently, and she knows people not because of the way they look, interestingly enough. She knows people by their voice matched with the smell of their who they are. So she would know me as Barb because of my voice and my smell together. And she's written some things, and one of the things she wrote is, I know that many of you can't wait for the time that you go to heaven because you can't wait to see Jesus, but I got to tell you, I can't wait to smell him. Wow, talk about expanding our world of who God is. Talk about expanding our world. I just think that that is an amazing opportunity for us to imagine God differently. And I tell you, I I can't wait to smell them. If God's preparing a feast for my eyes, why wouldn't God be preparing a feast for Sandra's nose? And altogether, this opportunity to meet Jesus has become a different thing in my mind. Sandra grew my world and my understanding of who God is just by the way God had created her and her explaining that to me. What a gift that she's part of my life. I hope you have such gifts in yours. All right, moving on. When we get back, we're going to again continue to talk about some examples, some opportunities that are involved. And so, a reminder, please take a look at those tools that we've just covered and see how can I put some things into action, what makes sense. Remember, you don't need the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder to use a good strategy. This might be just as effective for a teenager at home that has no diagnosis whatsoever. Strategies don't require a diagnosis. If you see something that you think would be helpful for an individual, do it. If your whole congregation would benefit by having a PowerPoint with a moving red line that says the schedule up there, go for it. Those are great ways, again, of thinking about strategies. But these were chosen because these specifically applied to persons with ASD have been shown to be helpful strategies. So enjoy picking some out and then tune back in when you're ready for another list of strategies to complete our time together this week.